So then I started working this. If the investment request is $8.7 million and $1.2 is for
acquisition.
The acquisition. Then it's effectively 1.2 and 1.2, so it's a 50-50 ownership just on that equation. But then this person...
How did it get to 1.2 and 1.2?
Your valuation at 1.2.
So it's 2.4 you add to the 7.5?
No, 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 no. No, he's not buying your portion. He's buying Larson's portion for 1.2.
What was the beginning number you said?
8.7.
8.7.
So he's going to pay 1.2 to then, take over Larson's
and
position.
And where's the other 1.2, you said? 1.2 and 1.2.
This is you, Jim. You're already in Landway. And now Joe is going to take out the Larson's. So now you and Joe are 50-50 instead of you and Mike.
Okay. You're accounting 1.2 that I already have. Got it.
Right. Yeah, Joe doesn't have to put cash in. He can sign for a loan of 7.5.
Still money.
It's still money. It's still responsibility. But if he really believes in this, and if what we say is true, that the business will be able to service the debt, it sure is different looking than if he put in 1.5 to become a 1/3 partner, and then the $800,000, which is a loan, which the Larsons wouldn't want to sign on.
As we pointed out today, $900,000.
Right. How embarrassing.
No, I changed the number. I forgot to do the math.
Anyway, he seems like a friendly guy.
Yeah.
He was getting excited about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, if the 7.5 isn't required all up front,
shouldn't be.
You know?
That's a phase.
Anyway, I did, I organized it a little bit differently where this is like what the whole thing looks like and then build it out in three phases.
So we should say up to.
Of course, who knows what the cost of things will be by the time we get there. We can't say up to, estimated is better, just in case costs exceed that.
Well, I wouldn't imagine that the guy is going to have an open-ended commitment.
Oh, no? Now, Jeff is somebody who does crowdfunding?
No. He's got salespeople who work with money pools, money guys.
So this could be
fund. That's where Steve Jones came in. He had the $200 million fund. And in the final analysis, it was they were buying existing parks east of the Mississippi. So...
$200 million. That's a lot of money. But if it's a big fund like that, they could buy the whole thing.
But they're not park operators. They would never do that. They would back credentialed management operators. And that's why we got to introduce the new team member. Now, I haven't figured out how to do that.
Well, you did have a general statement about hospitality.
Yeah.
And so, without being any specific. But now's the time to get a little specific.
And we have the turnaround crew.
Conversion. Room conversion.
Oh, that turnaround?
It could be turnaround, I don't care. Turn down, right? Because you turn down the bed and put your chocolate on it.
Oh, yeah.
That's turn down service. Do you want turn down service or not?
What did you have over there? Is that something to eat tonight or not?
I took the pork steaks out of the freezer just in case you wanted to.
Yeah, it's okay.
All right, put it back in the freezer.
Or on the refrigerator. I mean,
okay.
What are we going to have tomorrow night? Is it possibly?
I put a steak in the freezer to defrost for
tomorrow. Okay. What I'd like to do is have some of those beans up there. I was thinking about tomorrow.
What beans?
The pressure cooked beans.
Oh.
You got.
Go ahead. I didn't cook the soup. Yeah, this week.
But that would be...
Have some beans.
How would you do that? Just put a broth with them and heat them up?
Some of them are pinto beans.
I don't want any pinto beans. I'd like those white beans, like some white bean soup, thick and...
Mashed?
A little bit, yeah.
Well, there's... You want me to saute up some onion? I mean, that's what I would do. I'd do a little bit of onion... Put the beans in. Oh, we got leek. We got a shallot. It'd be lovely. And then put the white beans in. Cook them. And then put some... I've got some chicken broth in the refrigerator. And take the potato masher just to...
Mash them up a little bit.
But leave the texture. I gotta stop eating these. I mean, these are like...
I know, I've stopped.
All right, so we can work on this together tomorrow.
Yeah, we got to give thought to it, though, tonight because I'm going to be on the phone with Brian in the morning. So what are some of the possibilities?
You are doing your best to find a buyout for his dad. Well, there is some.
But it hasn't gone well.
Right.
Well, we really haven't tried. But the preliminary is, as I told him in the email. But we've recently gotten some encouragement. Brian.
So then, if a $1.2 million was offered, they would probably take it. But... Then is Larson expected to pay his portion to First Bank Yuma out of that? Or that's a separate funding?
I guess that would be part of the negotiations. Maybe he should pay it all.
Now, here's the thing. I don't want to be misperceived, so I can just tell you, and you know that my heart's in the right place. How much did you discount the note that he had with you?
I can't remember, but I think it was, I don't even remember the face amount. Was it $350 or $250?
I don't know. I guess I have to go back to the note.
Have to dig up the email. Well, we should have a file there of the emails that went for it.
Right.
We had Shayla draw up the modification.
Right. So, You think that the note was discounted by $100,000?
No, I think it was $75,000 or something like that.
Okay.
I mean, amazing? I don't know.
I mean, you know what? If we dwelled on it, and you know, beyond 30 days, it would take too much bandwidth. We have to, like, jettison shit out. Otherwise, our data bank is going to be gone. Seriously, in the final analysis, Mike is going to have to realize that he didn't have to pay that final amount. And so, you know, maybe he doesn't get as much at the end. You know, it's, that might be part of balancing the scales. He got a little lift here and he doesn't get as much there. And so, listen, if you got $1.2 million, you got to get a real number on what's owed to the bank. So we know.
I think we can call it 250 and then it'll be plus or minus.
I should probably be able to guesstimate based, I have statements, bank statements through December. I can get pretty close in 6 months. But anyway, so we'll go over all that, but do you think somebody's gonna, if they're pledging $7.5 million, it's their deal. It ends up being the Jacobson thing. Then it's your deal. I mean, it's Joe's deal.
What do you mean by that? What is your opinion? Is that his?
He's he got calls the shots? He's got 100% of it.
That's not his deal, though, because if it's his deal, then he gets to say, I want the road this wide. I want to make sure that we have the utilities here and not, you know, he's not going
to. But he's not qualified to do that because he hasn't spent the time to understand it. But
he has to have an agreement to who's going to manage the, and agree on a strategy and development plan and then execute it. But, yeah.
And Jeff should be able to advise you on that. I mean, you don't want to surrender your...
As Jeff has said, that's part of the negotiations. And he'll bring the buyer and then it's whatever the buyer and the seller work out.
Yeah, but Jeff needs to be an advisor to you. Like, you know,
what he's seen and the deals he's done will be valuable, yeah.
I mean, you don't want to waste anybody's time if somebody's going to offer you something that's just like wacky-wiggy.
I think I'll be able, and you will be able to determine what's wacky or not enough or a good deal.
I think what I'm saying is I think we should know what to expect before we're in a negotiation. Before we get an offer, we should know what the likely offer would be.
Possibilities.
So that, mm-hmm. Right, what the world of possibilities is. And then I'm, you know, like, what are my priorities? My priorities are to see this thing actualized. I would love to be able to participate in the process
of
it being actualized. I don't want to compromise my investment that's been made or the appreciation that it deserves. But I want to go into this with all humility, that if somebody brings that amount of power to bear to make it happen, I just...
You're not going to stand in the way.
I'm not going to stand in the way, and I would be extremely grateful, because anybody who's going to be in there, like, as we've said, they're not going to let that the project suffer. They're going to make sure that it, and I'm guessing that if we give more, well, I guess there are all kinds of assholes in the world, but if we give more, I think we might be given more in the end. You know what I'm saying? If we don't try to be greedy about it.
You know, people like that are like Greenberg, Chuck Greenberg.
They're greedy. Oh.
This is how they make money. You want to make a modification, that costs you half a point. You want an early draw, that's $2,500 more on, as a fee. That's how he did it, and he's a nice guy, love you, be good and all that, but business is business with him, and I wouldn't expect it to be too much different with anybody else that's out there. Of course, he was hard money, but so is what we're going after. These are investors that are putting their money to work, and their yield is what it's all about. And I think that they anticipate there'll be changes, for which there's a change fee. I'm sorry that I threw out the receipt, because I didn't record how much these 50 count.
How much did you pay it? You just swiped your card and don't know what you paid.
Yeah, they gave me a receipt and I threw it in the trash can on the way up.
And you bought the gum?
Correct. I stole it.
I mean, you bought the chocolate at... I'm trying to figure...
Yeah, this is Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's, right. So, I don't know.
72% cocoa dark chocolate.
Tomorrow I have got... For the next 30 days, I have got to go in my austerity program so that my blood work...
When is your blood work?
At the end of next month. I need 30 days of, like...
And then after that, you can go ahead and get back to normal?
No. Oh, it's funny. Gundry talks about a couple of places he's talked in his podcast and in his book. He talks about a patient that he had who was APOE4. And people with APOE4 crave cheese. He's not...
That must be me.
It must be me. He hasn't done a scientific study, but he's just seen that coincidentally, he can pretty much tell us about, without even the blood work, the people who come in with what their food, what they eat, and it's high cheese, he figures that they're APOE4, and he tests them, and they are.
What is APOE4, anyway?
It's a... genetic variant of lipid production.
Something they're born with.
Right.
Okay.
You can't turn off that gene. Either you are or there's an APOE3, APOE1, 2, 3, and 4. And so you have two genes, one from each parent. So you could be a 1-2, a 1-1, a 1-3, a 3-4, a 4-4, a 2-2. Got it? So, but if you've got one, a homogenous APOE4, or if you're heterozygous APOE4, you have a tendency to want your cheese. So anyway, long story short, so you've got this patient, and he's trying to impress on this patient, listen, your blood work has a problem. The blood doesn't lie. It comes back. You have got to knock off the cheese.
Because APO4 and cheese doesn't match.
Right. You eat the cheese and your lipid panel is out of whack. So he convinces this patient, okay, I know that I have a blood work, blood panel scheduled. I'm going to, like, do what you say, Dr. Gundry. Except for moi? Oh, this looks like we're on the American Airlines.
Oh, well, that's probably it. This is Iberico.
Oh, it's from Goat. Spain. It's Spanish. From
It's right. All Spanish cheese.
Oh, it's all but I did it upside down because the Iberian Peninsula is Spain and Portugal. I knew that. So he convinces his patient to, like, knock the cheese off. So he does. He gets his blood test back, and it is, like, really good. It moved clearly in the right direction. And Gundry says, see, I told you it was the cheese. And the guy says, well, that does it. Every time you order blood work, I'll just stop the cheese for 2 weeks before the test. And Gundry's going, you don't get it. He tells that story over and over again. And I'm just so identified.
That's funny.
His exact words were, the patient said, well, that's simple. For 2 weeks before the blood test, I'll just cut out cheese and you'll never know. That was the tagline, you'll never know. Like the guy was going to throw himself under the bus, but Gundry would never know. Oh, man.
That's so funny.
Right. But I mean, isn't that...
That's what you're doing.
Well, because I got you right, you got me cheese. Oh, man. Well, you know what? I would think you were trying to kill me with kindness if I had a big policy, but I don't have a big policy anymore, so, you got to take care of me.
Well, you're handling yourself pretty well.
I handle myself well.
You don't want to, you said?
I don't
want to
be. I don't want to handle myself well. I don't want to be a good girl. I love cheese.
Maybe you've got the APO gene.
Yeah. It's also the Alzheimer's gene.
Oh, well, we don't have that.
Well, and he talks to that. People say, I don't want to know if I have that gene. And he says, but just because you have the gene is not, and you have a predisposition to it. If you know that you have a predisposition, you can actually do something about it. Not knowing about it and just, like, doing what you want to do, then you're subject to destiny. But if you know about it and you...
Change your destiny.
Mitigate it. It's not a death sentence. It's not foregone conclusion. It's gene expression.
I heard a story on down the hall. They opened the door, and there was Susan Lynn laying on the floor. She was dead.
I got in the
father was, whatever.
I turned at the volume and got creeped out all over again.
But there was a story on that. It was creepy. And, husband and wife had two children, a four-year-old and a, I guess a seven-year-old. And they lived out in a rural area. And they went everywhere with the kids. And the kids were with them all the time. They were, but they were in a farm area where the kids could enjoy the land and the acreage that they had, and there was just nothing going on there. It was very safe. And the kids would always go out and play. And mom would go out at dinner time and call them in, just like we used to do. So, and the dad was working in one of the buildings on the property in the shop area. And mom was in-house cooking. And the seven-year-old was apparently in the house at the time, and the four-year-old was out for a minute or two. And so,
oh, don't tell me something tragic. I won't be able to sleep.
So, well, then I can't tell you, because anyway, the four-year-old was attacked by a dog, but nobody saw it. And the mom came out looking for, calling the girl, and the girl didn't answer, so the father went around out there and found the daughter, the four-year-old, laying down, bleeding. And the four-year-old said, the dogs attacked me. And she was bleeding. He was a former paramedic, I guess, or a paramedic, whatever. And she was badly bleeding. She had her femoral artery severed. So they immediately got her to the hospital, but she died from blood loss. And they accused the father and mother of occult and killed her, because the autopsy showed that the wound was not a dog bite. It was cut, it was a knife. And no matter what they said, and as believable as they were, they couldn't prove that they didn't do it. I mean, it was a knife cut. They're the only ones out there. And they found some occult paraphernalia or something in the house when they did a search. So they assumed that there was something about bloodletting, and they accused them of that. And they were convicted, and they went to jail. They couldn't believe that their daughter, who was, they didn't kill her, but they've been accused of doing it. So they spent 5 years in jail, and that's all I can imagine, 5 years of your life, knowing that you just got screwed. But somehow they were convincing enough to some investigator who went and took another look at it, and he found photos of what the wound looked like when the girl was brought into the hospital, which wasn't in evidence. And they asked during the initial trial to have an independent forensic opinion, and that was denied. And they were also denied access to some other files, which part of those files were these pictures. So they took these pictures and had them examined, and it was, yes, indeed, it was a dog. And what happened was, while they were trying to save the girl, they had to cut away the flesh, the dog bite stuff, to get in and repair the artery. So when, by the time the body, dead body, got to the coroner for the autopsy, it didn't show, it just showed the...
Oh my God!
So they went back to court and got it reversed, but And then, of course, it blew up the family because the 7-year-old was now 13, and in a foster home. Can you imagine a 7-year-old with in a foster home thinking her parents killed their sister? And so,
oh my God!
When they finally got out of jail, the marriage didn't work any longer, and they ended up separating. But that's a pretty sad story.
But you gotta wonder. I mean, that's so basic. Would it not be basic?
Well, and the dog, there were 3 dogs on the property, but they all had, they all seemed to have nice demeanors. There was a witness that wasn't either interviewed or something that did report that they had been, that she knew that the dogs had attacked several times. And so the dogs did have a history, but they seemed awfully nice and docile. And I can't imagine a dog taking a chunk out of a leg down to the artery and severing it. But
I don't know. There's stuff that comes across in headlines that I just don't even open it because the suggestion in the headline is just so bad. Why would I expose myself to that evil thought? But there was one where this 3-year-old or something was mauled to death by the 2 family dogs. You know, I mean, oh my God. You've heard the stories of infants in their cribs and the parents own snakes, boa constrictors, and then the kid ends up...
I have to say I have not heard that story.
Oh, oh man. A big lump in the belly of the boa constrictor. I mean...
Where's little Pamela? Oh, I wonder.
Oh, geez. I mean, just... What are they thinking? Terrible, terrible, terrible. Well, I just want to say one more thing about Jeff. In the 15 minutes we were on the phone, I heard him express his advocacy.
Yeah.
So I just
wanted... I got that in the first call. The call that you said, wow, you were very upset in there. Remember that call? That's when he wasn't and I wasn't. But that was the call that when we finished it, he was going, wow,
upset that you were heightened, that you were piqued. Your yeah. energy level was, not that you were upset, but that you were a high energy.
I was.
Okay.
But it was in that call that I got the real essence, the whole sizzle about this project. And that's when he made the comment. That's when he really turned around and thought, this is really a hot deal. Just don't go out there in the next 90 days. No way.
Right. And if you get a photo gallery, you know how you click, 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 and the photos come through, you know?
Slideshow.
Oh, man, and everybody's reporting all the... That the whole West in the desert, national news.
I know.
Tucson is melting.
Record
heat.
128 in Death Valley.
Really? 128? Good God. I'm That's scary.
But you know, I drove over from here. I didn't get out of the car until I got to Yuma. And I took the picture of the
120.
But when I got to Yuma to get out to get gas, it was like, oh my gosh, this is really hot. It was just really unbelievable. And then I got back in the car, and then I got to the campground, and I was hot, but I wasn't remarking so much about it because it still was like 118.
And then your phone died because it was overheated. That's right. Pretty damn hot.
Yeah. So, in the subsequent days that I was there, it was just as hot, maybe 2 degrees less, but it just, it didn't bother me, or I didn't notice it, I guess. Except when I did the work with the batteries, I waited until about 8 o'clock. Each one of those batteries weighed probably 80 pounds. 80 to 90 pounds. I'd say 80 pounds. And just lifting them out of the bed of the truck, into the bed of the truck, and then out of the bed of the truck, and then put the old ones into the bed of the truck, and take them out of the bed of the truck, and then put them into the car, is not any time-consuming effort. It's just heave-ho, and then heave-ho. But I did feel a little lightheaded a couple of times in that one of those lifts. And I was remarking to myself, because it was like 5 years ago or 6 years ago, I was out there in 120 degree temperature fixing the water supply at the house. And I had to walk back and forth between the pump house where the power was and the pump, the powerhouse and the pump. And then while I was out at the pump, I had to lay on the ground and get under and tighten up, so I was exerting myself. And that's when I overheated. I know I overheated, but I didn't get sick, which is a sign. I sat in the shade and drank some canned beverages. Or no, I had the water then, which was like hot water. I poured it on myself. But I know I definitely had my core temperature way up there. I wouldn't have been able, I think today, I wouldn't be able to do that.
No, you'd have to let it go. But God willing, we won't have to face this. But come next February, you assess those batteries. And if something needs to be, that you anticipate it needs to be changed, you change it in February. Why wait until June, for God's sake?
I did it in February. But
You didn't take two out of cycle and put two new ones in, did you?
I put six batteries in.
In February of this year?
Well, maybe it was in the fall. Yeah, those are recent batteries, six of them. And I kept the two newest ones just to save money, because they're $110 a piece. And then the last time I was out there, I checked them. They were definitely bad. And so I knew I had to, the rest looked like they were okay. And so when I went out this time, I checked the six that were good, and they were perfect. They didn't even have any need for water. But the two bad ones were bad. And so now, okay, I think it's really good.
We do it in February. We clean it up in February. And then,
you know, if it doesn't need to be replaced, you don't.
Okay, but my point is, you evaluate the pressure points, and then, you know, the pressure points have to be resolved by March 30th. And if not, they have to go. You can't compromise yourself like that.
I didn't. We didn't. That was 6 years ago.
No, but even 2 days ago, lifting them and so forth, added with the heat.
It was, at that time, the temperature was probably only about 105, which is...
Oh, it takes my breath away.
Well, no, it's not bad then. But when you get to close to 120, it's pretty, you can't be walking around doing much outside.
Hell no.
But you know, that's the thing. You just, if you live out there, you just are inside during the day.
I remember living in Scottsdale. In the summer.
What do you need to do outside anyway? If you have to go somewhere, you get in your car and then you
go. But I certainly never witnessed my folks doing any arduous work outside. No, But I do remember when my dad came over and got the job when we were moving and we were selling the house there in Scottsdale. On East Turney Road. Dad was over here. We're selling the house. So he... outlined that if I just kept the grass edging trimmed, that the grass would look okay while we were... showing the house. And I remember being out there in the dark with a flashlight, with a scissor.
I know, it's hot, isn't it, at night, isn't it?
You know, so that by this time the sun was coming up, I was done. Wherever I was on the edging of the lawn with my scissor, I didn't even have pruners. I just kept, like every morning I would go out with my scissor and edge as far as I could go. And then the next morning I'd go out in the dark with my flashlight and edge further. And I just like made the rounds. And keep it trimmed. I didn't realize I was being indoctrinated into the world of real estate back then. You know, and we'd be going somewhere. We would not open the door until we were all at the door.
Yeah.
And then we would open the door and we'd exit and close the door. It's like, you don't let one drop of the air conditioning out.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And oh man, the car would be so hot, we'd have to bring towels.
Yeah, wear gloves.
I never had my hands on the steering wheel back then, but we had to bring a towel, put it on the seat, sit on it. We'd burn ourselves. Terrible. And that was before seat belts. So when I would drive with my mother.
Really?
We had.
Yeah, I guess it was, so. Yeah, 1961.
In the 50s. We moved to Arizona in 57.
That's when seat belts were coming in mandatory.
We didn't have them there, and we had a blue. I think it was a blue Pontiac station wagon, was it? And it had a complete bench front seat. And so Mom would drive, and I would be in the passenger seat, and Tony would be between us. And I don't know what I used. I can't remember what I used, but it was kind of like a file folder kind of thing. And I would always make sure that Tony was completely shaded, no matter how we were positioned in driving. There was absolutely no sun on him, but he was always in front of the vents to keep him cool. And
amazing.
Mom was on one side, I was on the other, so we just kind of sheltered him. And it was like heightened sensitivity.
What an experience.
Somebody, you know, one of the doctors said, you know, he would do so much better in San Diego where there was some moisture in the air. The dry air, just aggravating.
Really? You'd think it would dry it out or keep it...
No, when your mucous membranes get too dry, they don't function.
They just cling to them.
They shut down when your your mucous membranes have to have it's a moisture environment. Anyway, so then we came over to San Diego, and it was a miracle that we got my dad got a job at the Union Tribune, because he was gonna leave us here and go back and work there.
What a terrible life.
And Jim Brown, who was his boss, was very sympathetic to my dad and brought his case to Jim Copley. When we first... Not when we first lived here. He first got the job, and then he left to go to the New York Times Western Edition in L.A. And so he quit. And nobody ever quit the Union Tribune that Copley ever hired back. So we left and we went to the New York Times Western Edition. And like 4 months, some short time, 6 months after we got there, the paper closed.
Where, what city were you in then?
In Torrance.
You moved to Torrance.
We moved to Torrance from San Diego.
Oh, I see. So you moved from Scottsdale to San Diego, and then San Diego to Torrance, and then that back again.
No, then from there, he wasn't going to get back at the Union Tribune because Jim Copley doesn't hire anybody back that quit. So Dad had to take the job back at the New York Times and said, we all have to move back to New York.
So gosh.
So we left Torrance. It was at the end of the school year. We moved back to New York. It was the first and only time I went to public school. And Tony did terribly. Nearly died.
How old was he then?
I was in the eighth grade. So I don't know how old I was. Six, seven, maybe 13. Mm-hmm. I was 13, so he was 5 years younger. So he was like seven, eight. He was hospitalized then. It was one of the two times he was hospitalized.
In New York.
In New York. And we were there only a couple of months, and Mom said, we have to go back to San Diego. It's where he did the best. And so
gosh,
I got in the car with Dad. I drove cross country. I think it only took us 4 days to get from New York to San Diego. We stayed at the Vagabond Hotel in Mission Valley. We found an apartment up by Sharp Hospital on Nightingale Way. Our apartment overlooked the pool. We got that apartment because swimming was going to be good for Tony, having that pulmonary exercise. So then, with the plan that Dad was going to get us here, get us set up in the apartment, and he was going to then return to New York and continue working at the New York Times.
What kind of money did it take then? Did you have?
I have no idea. I mean, I didn't know where money came from. Oh,
right,
I was 12.
Sure.
I was 12. When we got there, I was 12. So when we were there, we were back in town, and so somehow, I don't know if Dad called Jim Brown, who had been his old boss, or what, but he met Jim for lunch. So Jim Brown knew the situation. And so Dad told him that he was going to go back to New York. So unbeknownst to my dad, Jim Brown goes to Copley and says, this is the situation with Mickey Platt. And he's leaving his family here because he doesn't have a job here. He's going to be back in New York, and his family's going to be here for health reasons. And Copley said, have him come back to work. I mean, talk about grace. It was just...
Well, he understood the reason that he left the first time, right?
Well, no, he left the first time to go back to his first love, the New York Times.
Not because of the medical situation with Tony.
No, he abandoned Copley to go to the New York Times in Los Angeles.
I see.
And so, I mean, that was not good. But the situation imploded after that. And so anyway, Copley understood the story, told Brown, have him come back. Dad was like going to leave the next day and was saved by the bell. And so he resumed work there. And then what is this? School's out 2021. Oh, this must be the balloons. Wait, where'd it go? You took that Jason made?
Well, I'm sure he had to put it, because it's no doubt very long. Very big file. You got to put it up on the YouTube in order to make it available to see.
Oh, you're sure the bus, Mr. James.
Six forty-seven p.m. June 18, 2021.